Welcome to the Whence We Came Project Podcast, an archived audio anthology of American lives, both local and legendary, as told by the Americans that live them. My name is John Owen, and I'll be your host today. The following is my conversation with Rick Garrels. I met Rick a few years ago through his son, Braden, who worked at a local business that I was involved with. Rick is a quietly spoken man with deep interest and convictions. Raised in part in Alaska, Rick loves the outdoors, a throwback kind of guy that at times almost seems like he stepped out of the early 1900s. A man of conviction and faith, I am richly blessed to call him friend. Please enjoy my conversation with Rick Garrels.
Well, I was born in 1966, January 23rd, 1966. My grandfather, Richard J. Reimer, said it was the coldest day that month of January, but in Wadena, Minnesota. I was born to Dale and Jean Garrels. My dad was in the Air Force back then. My mom was born into the Reimer family, who were farmers in Minnesota, right between Wadena and Deer Creek. I lived there for a few years. We lived in Wadena in town, and we moved to, my dad got transferred to Texas, to San Antonio. And I don't remember those years really, but there's pictures of me and our family when we lived in San Antonio. And my dad was totally a car guy. He had a really slick convertible when he met my mom. He met my mom at an A&W root beer stand.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my mom and her sister were both roller skate, servers. Yep. For A&W. And in fact, when they told me when dad pulled up, they kind of fought over who was going
to
serve this slick service guy in a convertible, but my mom won the toss and was introduced to him. But
quick question, Rick. Yeah. Your maternal grandparents lived in that same town or that close by in Minnesota. Is that correct?
Yes.
How about your paternal grandparents, your dad's parents?
My dad's parents lived in Florida.
Okay.
Yes. My grandfather on my dad's side was gone already.
Sorry. Okay.
He was in the Air Force also, and he was a Dale Garrels, the first, was, I'm the third, by the way.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Dale Garrels was a fighter pilot in the Air Force. Brilliant man, very smart, was in an accident with a train.
Hmm.
And messed him up pretty bad, but we lost him early on. I didn't ever get to meet him or know him.
I see.
So my grandmother, on my dad's side, they grew up in Nebraska and then moved over to the East Coast, to Virginia, and then she met my step-grandfather, T.K. Wiley, Talmadge Wiley. He was a weapons... I couldn't tell you the exact terminology of what his title was, but he worked with weapons in the Navy.
Okay.
And they lived in Orlando, Sanford, Florida,
okay.
Actually.
Yep.
So that's where they were.
Gotcha.
For most of the time I've known them.
Okay, you can get back to San Antonio now. I was wondering about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we lived in San Antonio for a while and then moved back to Minnesota. And mom and dad bought a farm outside of Deer Creek and close to her family. And that's where I, my early formative years of just loving to be outside were on the farm.
Right.
I was always outdoors. Mom's got a picture of me hanging on the screen door, and just as a tiny little kid. And in fact, we had a thunderstorm one night, and I was hanging on the screen door watching, because I always loved watching thunderstorms. I still do to this day. I just, yeah, I love storms. I was at least standing and touching that metal screen door, and a bolt of lightning hit our plum orchard across the driveway and knocked me right on the floor.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Wow.
But
brothers and sisters?
I have a sister and a brother and a half-brother.
Okay.
Which is brother, you know.
Right.
Jody is 7 years younger than me. Justin is 12 years younger than me. And Brandon is 18 years younger than I am.
Gotcha. Okay.
So I was the only child on the farm there until Jody came around. And then shortly after that, she was born in 73. We moved. Dad had a friend who'd gone up to Alaska to work in the oil field, or as the oil fields were being developed.
Yeah.
He went up there for that kind of gold rush. A lot of Midwesterners had up there. There was a lot of Minnesotans actually in Alaska too for that whole era. But in 74, he went up in 73 and started working for a cargo airline that was supplying the oil fields in the North Slope, doing rig moves and stuff like that, because there was no road infrastructure, you know, yet. So they would fly oil rigs in C-130s.
Oh, wow.
To different locations, yeah. So Alaska, Fairbanks especially, was booming at that point. And so he talked Mom into moving up there. And in 74 is when we moved to Fairbanks. I was 8. And we kept the farm. We just leased it out. We moved to Fairbanks. And that was quite an adjustment. But as a boy, adventure.
Yeah.
I mean, I was blessed with adventure from the get-go. When I was 6, my mom and dad got me a go-kart. And
6.
Yeah. And I was just sucker punched with the passion of driving from the start. You know, just the passion of, you know, doing that kind of thing. And we moved to Fairbanks 74, and we moved to Anchorage in 78. So I was from 8 to 12 years old in Fairbanks. And Jody was born in 73 back at the farm in Minnesota. And so we were both born in Wadena. And then Justin came along in 1978 in Fairbanks.
I see.
Yeah. So he was born in the...
What's the difference in those two cities? At that point in time, what was the difference in those two cities? Much?
Which cities?
Fairbanks and Anchorage.
Okay. Fairbanks is the most interior town, biggest interior town in Alaska, and Anchorage is a coastal town. So Anchorage has more of a temperate temperature, you know, coastal temps. Fairbanks has extremes. It'll get very warm in the summertime. If it's dry, they'll have forest fires in the summertime because of the dryness. And then, so we're talking 75, 80 in Fairbanks. And it's dry up there. And then, but in the wintertime, it's so isolated and gets very, very cold. We experienced 50 below temps many times when I was a kid. And what strikes me about Fairbanks is there's hardly wind there, which is a good thing if it's that cold.
Right.
But what that cold would bring is ice fog. And because Fairbanks is a river town, Chena River flows through Fairbanks, and I remember seeing 6 inches of snow piled up on a telephone wire.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and you know it's frost built up,
right?
And snow,
when we think of those cities at that point in time in 73, 74, 75, what city in the United States would remind you? Is it like the same type of architecture and whatever you see in Nashville? Or, I mean, just a regular city life like any other city in the United States? Or was there anything different about those cities?
No. Cities in Alaska that have a population of 10,000 or greater are like any other city in the United States. Some of their structures are different, you know, but no, it would look like any other city.
I see.
Now you get to villages in Alaska, total different story.
Okay.
You know, and there are many, Inupiat Indians, you know, Eskimo peoples call them, but, natives of that region. There are a lot of villages out there, and they are quite different from regular city.
Was the relationship good between the native people there and Americans from the Continental 48? At least at that point in time, we're talking that time frame of the 70s.
At this point in time in the 70s, the government was starting to subsidize the natives because of where they lived was rich with resource.
I see.
Yeah. So, but I don't think we as red-blooded Americans really treated them very well.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't, you know, I mean, some did, but overall, I think they were, that's hard to pin down how I want to describe that, but
are you thinking like a second class citizen?
Yeah. Okay. That kind of.
Yeah, that's sad.
Yeah, it is. It is very sad, because they have such rich history.
Right. Was there anything different about those cities?
No. Cities in Alaska that have a population of 10,000 or greater are like any other city in the United States. But now you get to villages in Alaska, total different story.
Okay.
You know, and there are many. Inupiat Indians, you know, Eskimo peoples call them, but natives of that region. There are a lot of villages out there, and they are quite different from regular city.
Was the relationship good between the native people there and Americans from the Continental 48? At least at that point in time, we're talking that time frame of the 70s.
At this point in time in the 70s, the government was starting to subsidize the natives because of where they lived was rich with resource. But I don't think we as red-blooded Americans really treated them very well. Mm-hmm. I don't. Speaking of that, my wife works for or has worked for a small consulting firm based out of Anchorage for the last 26 years or so. And the guy who runs that, Bill Dan, is from California. But when he finished college, he moved to Alaska, moved to remote Alaska, and met a native woman named Jenny and married her. And through that relationship, they consulted some of these corporations that natives would form because they had money from the government, right?
Right.
You know, so they needed to organize and do what they needed to support their tribes and everything. So they looked to consulting firms to help them organize.
I see.
And they ended up working for a lot of medical health organizations within the native tribes. But Jenny she's a teacher, and she had an opportunity to go back to Nome and take a class. There's an island out there that you can see Russia from, right? You know, people talk about that.
Yeah.
They had an opportunity to meet, to take some of the kids from Nome or Kotchubey, one of those, and meet the natives from Russia.
Oh, wow.
It was a big deal, and they met at this island, and they were concerned about the language barrier, mm-hmm. and when they met, they discovered that the language was the same. Right. Yeah, you know, what so yeah, so.
Now, when you were in school there,
mm-hmm.
was it fairly mixed in terms of how many Native kids went to school? Does everybody mix in the schools up there at that time? Did they?
They did.
Okay.
They did, but Fairbanks was mostly, most of the Natives back then still lived in the villages.
Okay.
You know, some lived in town, but a small percentage did. So we didn't, you know, we didn't have a lot of Native mixed in with our population.
How about in the field working? Did a lot of the Natives work on the pipeline and different things like that, or was that mostly people from the United States and some other countries?
It was mostly tradesmen.
Wow.
That I know of.
Yeah.
It was mostly tradesmen. Yeah, the percentage of Natives weren't educated in those things.
Yep.
You know, I mean, they were primal educated. You know, they were very skilled at their own life and how to live life and how to sustain their life in an Arctic region, which is amazing.
Yeah, that's a great skill.
Yeah.
I think we could probably learn a lot from
absolutely
at this point in time.
But growing up there as a boy was so valuable to me, you know, because I was an outdoors kid. I was hardly inside playing, you know, I was always outside. Back on the farm in Minnesota, my mom would find me when it's raining really hard in the doghouse with the dog.
Wow.
Yeah, I'd just be out there,
yeah,
you know, and hanging out with my buddy. But
tell me some of the things you did outdoors in Alaska.
We would go hunt squirrels when I was a kid in Fairbanks, and snow machining. Fantastic fun. I was a Boy Scout in Fairbanks. I had a friend named David Nesting when we first moved to Fairbanks that lived in the neighborhood. And we would build these, well, actually, we would build these snowbanks. They would be half built already, you know, and we would tunnel snowbanks and make rooms and stuff in there and things like that.
That's remarkable. Yeah. To a guy that's never seen more than 6 or 7 inches of snow in his life, and he's 65. I can't imagine that. Well,
and that started in Minnesota because my grandpa would come with his tractor in the wintertime, and he'd push all the snow between the house and the barn up into this huge snow pile. And that was just
and it had the consistency place for you to be able to tunnel in it? It didn't fall in on you?
No. So the snow there was dense. It wasn't as dry.
Okay.
In Minnesota.
Yeah.
In Fairbanks, it was more dry. So you couldn't really tunnel like you could in the snow in Minnesota. But we used to make rooms and stuff, and
that's so neat.
Just had a blast with that stuff.
Yeah.
And what's funny about that is I'm claustrophobic.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm claustrophobic because I had a neighbor friend, Chip mm-hmm. Tramby, and I. My dad had a sliding camper that he had parked by the garage on the farm. And it was just, it wasn't on his pickup. It was just sitting over there. And Chip and I, we did everything together, just so augmented by living on a farm. But we got it crawled in that camper one day, and we're goofing off. And there was a little closet and back then, you know, this is the early 70s. You know, the latches on the door were latches, right?
Yep.
And I don't really understand what gave us the idea to crawl in that closet together and close the door.
Wow.
But we closed the door, and we couldn't get it open. And I immediately started to freak out. A little Chip Tramby, he's a little smaller than I am, a year younger. He's just cool as ever. I just remember him, you know, and I'm just flipping out. And I said, you know, we got to get out of here. And he's like, hey, Rick, I think we can do it and whatever. And I just finally busted the door open. I couldn't take it anymore. And after that, when I slept at night, now I slept in the second story of our house in Minnesota with no air conditioning. And so in the summer it's warm, it's pretty hot. So the windows would be open, I'd have a fan on. And but if I went to bed thinking about a tunnel or culvert or anything that I was in. I couldn't fall asleep until my arms and legs were stretched completely out.
Welcome to the Whence We Came Project Podcast. My name is John Owen, and I'll be your host today. The following is my conversation with Rick Garrell.
In Fairbanks, it was more dry, so you couldn't really tunnel like you could in the snow in Minnesota. But we used to make rooms and stuff, and just had a blast with that stuff.
Yeah.
And what's funny about that is I'm claustrophobic.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm claustrophobic because I had a neighbor friend, Chip Tramby, and I. My dad had a sliding camper that he had parked by the garage on the farm, and it was just, it wasn't on his pickup. It was just sitting over there. And Chip and I, we did everything together, just so augmented by living on a farm. But we got it crawled in that camper one day, and we're goofing off, and there was a little closet with the, and back then, you know, this is the early 70s, you know, the latches on the door were latches, right?
Yep.
And I don't really understand what gave us the idea to crawl in that closet together and close the door.
Wow.
But we closed the door, and we couldn't get it open. And I immediately started to freak out. A little Chip Tramby, he's smaller than I am, a year younger. He's just cool as ever. I just remember him, you know, and I'm just flipping out. And I said, you know, we got to get out here. And he's like, hey, Rick, I think we can do it and whatever. And I just finally busted the door open. I couldn't take it anymore. And after that, when I slept at night, now I slept in the second story of our house in Minnesota with no air conditioning. And so in the summer it's warm, it's pretty hot. So the windows would be open, I'd have a fan on. But if I went to bed thinking about a tunnel or culvert or anything that I was in, I couldn't fall asleep until my arms and legs were stretched completely out.
That's amazing. A true significant emotional event.
Absolutely. Hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And to this day, you know, if I daydream about being stuck with my arms in like that, I can't. There's no way I'll fall asleep.
Wow.
But Fairbanks was snow machining outside was a blast. Lots of places to go up there. You know, you could just go wherever. In fact, back then, people used snow machines to get around in the winter, you know. But so motorized things, you know. We did a little bit of skiing. Really, that's about, I didn't do a lot of hunting when I was that age. Just squirrels, you know, and we'd go out to the woods and cut trees for firewood and stuff like that.
Is that how you heated your home? Firewood?
Nope. We lived in town.
Okay.
But we had a fireplace.
Okay. Lived in town both in
Fairbanks. In Anchorage and Fairbanks, yep. Okay. Yep. Yep. So, 78, we moved to Anchorage. And I finished junior high and went into high school there, graduated high school there. We lived in Sand Lake. And one of my best friends to this day, Rusty, I met in junior high. And back then I wore hats like I do today.
Right.
And I always wore old Minnesota feed hats, you know, Funk's G Hybrid and decab corn hats, you know, just real dorky farm boy, you know. But I met this boy named Rusty Storjahan. He was from Iowa, so we became friends because we had that in common, you know. And they had moved up not long before we did. But got into sports in high school. Played football, played baseball. Never played basketball. Too much running. Too much constant running. And I never really studied the sport well in order to. And if I had, I believe I would have been even better than I was, you know. I think I was just kind of going through the motions of what kids do, you know, mm-hmm. at that age.
Yeah.
Again, adventure, you know, we camped and really enjoyed camping outdoors, and Dad would take us fishing. When I was in high school, when I was 15, Dad had some friends in Seward, Alaska, who ran a commercial fishing site in Bristol Bay. Bristol Bay, Quijack River, is one of the richest salmon places in the world. And these guys had a beach site, a set net site is what they call them. And the summer I was 15, I went out to work for them. And I spent most of the summer out there with them, most of my summer break out there with them.
What did that job entail?
We would set nets out on the beach. It was real shallow part of the bay. And so we had anchors that we'd screw into the beach. And we'd stretch out our nets, and then when the tides come in, they'd fill the nets with fish, and we'd go out as the tide was receding and pick them.
Okay.
We'd tie a Rubbermaid trash bin to our belt loop,
mm-hmm.
and pull fish out of the net and put them in a tote. And then we had a track ranger that was like a little dozer without a blade on it. And we towed this big trailer with big aircraft tires on it. So we'd load this trailer with all these fish, and then we'd load those into a big fishing boat. It was an open bow.
How big were these fish?
They're about 6 to 8. No, they're about 4 to 6 pounds
okay.
each. And they'd be anywhere from 18 inches long. Well, and we'd catch king salmon. In fact, the only way I've ever caught a king salmon in my life is with my hands. Never caught one on a rod and reel.
Wow.
Because when we were picking fish, and king salmon brought more money than sockeyes did, red salmon. So the nets we used were designed more for red salmon. So the kings would hit the net, but they wouldn't get caught. They would just get stopped, right? And then as the tide's going out, they'd be in shallow water. Well, whenever we saw a king,
right,
that, you know, that was in shallow water, we'd run after it, dive and tackle a fish, yeah, and throw it up on the beach. And you know, king salmon can get up to 100 pounds.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
I didn't realize that.
These kings that we were, you know, introduced to in that area would get up to about 60 pounds.
That's a big fish.
40 pounds, yes, yeah. Right. But,
wow.
So we would pick the fish, and then depending on how long the opening was for that period, we could fish. If they closed it, we'd gather up the nets and wait for the next opening. You know, and in between time, we'd be repairing nets,
right,
retying nets. And over there was no power, no running water, nothing. So we were staying in a cabin, and there was a cabin and a little Quonset hut with some bunks in it, and that's where I slept with the other crew.
About how many people?
There was about 6 guys. When I was working down there, I worked down there 15, 16, 17, those 3 years.
Okay.
Of age. And in that time, I had experiences, you know, commercial fishing that are unique. And one of them was we'd take a skiff up the river to old abandoned canneries and get supplies. There'd be stuff that they'd leave there, you know, beds, you know, plywood, we'd go up and get supplies from time to time. And this one time we're up there, we're going up there. Right swimming next to us were beluga whales.
Oh, and my gosh.
A beluga whale is a smaller of the whale species, but it's huge in comparison to fish that we catch, right?
Right.
They're like, you know, 12 feet long or more, and they've got a blunt nose, and they're white.
Peculiar. peculiar.
But there were salmon in the river, so they ate the salmon, but they were swimming right next to us. Yeah, so that was pretty neat. Yeah, that was very special. Almost lost my life in Bristol Bay.
How's that?
We were done with our season, and one of the boys of the guy who owned the permits had a site on the other side of the river from us in a deeper section of river. And he still had about a week or so of fishing left. And so we were done wrapped up. They asked me if I'd go help him that last week. And, yeah, no sweat, you know. And but over there, it wasn't shallow. You know, it was a deeper part. So we'd go out and pick fish from the boat most of the time. And so when the tide turns, you take your boat out, a skiff, like a John boat here, only bigger, and you pull up to the net, and you pull it over the bow, and you pull it to the middle of the boat, and you pull yourself along the net, pulling salmon into the net. Well, it was a beautiful day. Nice. This fishing was slow. There wasn't much out there. And so I went out by myself. And I went out and pulled up to this net and pulled it over and worked my way down it. And and you're wearing full rain gear. You know, you got waders on, hip waders.
Oh wow.
And you have bibs and a raincoat jacket. You know, they're all Grundon style or Helly Hansen stuff, heavy. And so I was done with this net, and I was pushing it back over to drop it in the water, and it caught my arm. It flipped me right over the boat and into the water.
Welcome to the Whence We Came Project Podcast. My name is John Owen, and I'll be your host today. The following is my conversation with Rick Garrels.
Almost lost my life in Bristol Bay.
How's that?
We were done with our season, and one of the boys of the guy who owned the permits had a site on the other side of the river from us in a deeper section of river. He still had about a week or so of fishing left, and so we were done wrapped up. They asked me if I'd go help him that last week, and yeah. And but over there, it wasn't shallow. You know, it was a deeper part, so we'd go out and pick fish from the boat. And so when the tide turns, you take your boat out, a skiff, like a John boat here, only bigger, and you pull up to the net, and you pull it over the bow, and you pull it to the middle of the boat, and you pull yourself along the net, pulling salmon into the net. Well, it was a beautiful day. Nice. This fishing was slow. There wasn't much out there. And so I went out by myself. And I went out and pulled up to this net and pulled it over and worked my way down it. And and you're wearing full rain gear. You know, you got waders on, hip waders.
Oh, wow.
And you have bibs and a raincoat jacket. You know, they're all Grundon style or Helly Hansen stuff. And so I was done with this net, and I was pushing it back over to drop it in the water, and it caught my arm. It flipped me right over the boat and into the water. I grabbed onto the side of the boat, and then now I'm drifting with the boat because there's tides going out, you know.
Gosh.
and so I worked my way down. Fortunately, we were away from the net. I worked my way down to the shallowest portion of the boat, and I tried to lift myself up over, and I couldn't do it. My boots were filled with water, and I couldn't get them off. So I tried several times to get up over the side of the boat, and I couldn't do it. And so I'm tired, you know, and I'm just kind of drifting with the boat. And I said, "You've got to do this." And so I gave it everything I had. And that last time, I was able to get my foot on the side of the boat. You know, why didn't think to maybe crawl up the motor or something like that? I don't know. But I was able to get my foot up there, and I got myself in the boat. And I just laid the bottom of the boat.
That's amazing.
Just happy that, you know, I had got over the side of it. I didn't tell my mom that story until, you know, like 15 years later, and she was white as a ghost when I told her. But anyway, you know, you look back in your life, and it's a lot easier to see where God's been.
True.
I'm very, very grateful that my grandmother, Esther, was just a very passionate about God and very much a believer, and instilled that into my mom. And so we, you know, we grew up knowing God. Knowing God was there.
Right.
And but like I said, it's easy to look back and see exactly where he had his hand, you know. And there are so many.
Right. Right.
So many when you understand. But so was in high school at that point.
And when's your brother born? While you're in high school?
He was born in 78. Right. Okay. Before we moved to Anchorage.
Okay.
My next brother.
So,
yep.
Okay.
Yep. So there's Jody, born in 73. Justin was born in 78.
Gotcha. Okay.
Given a car when I was 16.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Dad brought this 67 El Camino home from work one day. And it was way before my birthday. He was fixing it up to sell it, to flip it. And I just fell in love with it, of course. You know, I was that stage of life where I was...
Sure.
Just into it. Sure enough, for my birthday, my mom made a cake with the outline of an El Camino. It was yellow. It was school bus yellow. And in the key, in the cake they gave me, the key was in it. So that was cool. And, man, I had some fun with that car in high school. Because back then, we used to cruise, you know. In Anchorage, in the middle of Anchorage, was three lanes one way and then three lanes another way a block over. And it was the perfect circuit, you know, for cruising. Yep. Man, those are some of my favorite times of high school was, but we cruised. It was all about the cars. Just had a blast doing that. In high school, after I started driving my car to school, it was snowing one day. We used to leave for lunch. We'd go to Taco Time or somewhere and get lunch and come back. And it had snowed probably about 2 or 3 inches.
And was that part of the school curriculum that you were, or did you just leave school?
No, it was lunchtime, and you were allowed to leave school.
Yeah, we were too. And that,
yeah.
It's different nowadays.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were allowed to stay there and eat at the cafeteria or go wherever.
Right.
And so we would. And I came back one day from lunch, and there was a big empty part of the parking lot, and it snowed about 2 or 3 inches, and I'm out there whipping Brodies in the parking lot. And this is, I was 16, and of course they gave me the car in January, right? And, so I'm with Broder. There's not thinking anything of, but how fun, much fun I was having. And I parked the car and I'm walking in, and Mrs. McLaughlin.
You remember her name.
She was the security guard.
Yeah.
Security. And Coach Tomlin was also one of the security guards. He was a big guy. He used to play Chicago Bears football.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm walking in to go to fifth period, and she's walking out the door, and she says, "Give me your keys, please." And I'm like, "What?" She said, "Yeah." She said, "I saw you out there whipping Brodies. You need to give me your keys." I said, "I'm not giving you my keys to my car." She said, "Well, I've already called the cops, and they're on the way." And everybody back then knew who the cop was around there, and he was, nobody liked him, right? You know, he was one of those guys, you know, it's like, oh no, you know, so she said, "Well, you just head on to fifth period and I'll come get you when he gets here." And so I'm sweating bullets. and get to fifth period, and it was industrial arts class. It was like wood shop or something.
Right.
And I couldn't concentrate on nothing. I was thinking, oh my gosh, how much trouble I'm going to be in, you know, and I just couldn't even think straight, but nobody came and got me. So I was walking back when fifth period ended. I walked back towards my locker, and there's Miss McLaughlin in the student center. And I walked up to her, and she said, well, he showed up. I said, but there wasn't a problem.
Wow.
And I could have kissed her. Yeah. I could have hugged her and kissed her at that point.
Right.
And you know, she, of course, never called the cops.
Right. Right.
but her method worked very, very well.
Absolutely.
And
to this day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And yeah, she would tell you the same story today. And we became, of course, very good friends.
That's great.
You know, I wasn't a troublemaker in school.
Right.
And she knew that anyway, but
exactly.
Gosh, she did so well scaring them.
Now, what was the name of your high school?
Diamond High School.
Diamond High School in Anchorage.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And your junior high school?
Was Mears.
Mears. Okay.
Yep. I went to Hunter Elementary in Fairbanks. I don't remember the junior high. I started in Fairbanks before we moved. But Mears and then Diamond.
Gotcha. Okay.
And the funny thing about Diamond High School is it was designed by a Californian. They had outside hallways.
In Anchorage, Alaska?
In Anchorage, Alaska.
Wow.
So you're very unfortunate if you got your lockers by the doors.
Oh, I bet.
Because it was always cold.
Yeah.
You know, of course, many years after we graduated, they closed all those hallways in, you know. But anyway, and it's totally different now. But good memories playing summer rec baseball with some buddies.
Yeah.
Did that for a while. My parents divorced when I was a sophomore.
Okay.
And I didn't see it coming.
Oh.
Yep. Didn't see it at all. And then they kind of announced it. You know, so it was a pretty big blow.
Right.
And, you know, when a young man's going through those years in their life, they're really needing a role model.
No doubt.
You know. So
was it amicable? Were they friendly afterwards? I mean, did that?
Yeah, they've remained friends over time.
Mm. And you stayed with your mother?
Mom, yeah. And so that kind of made things weird.
Sure.
My junior and senior year. And then Mom dated after a little while, you know, and stuff like that. But after I graduated high school, I drifted. You know, I did. I moved in with a buddy. I worked at Food Services of America, loading trailers with food and stuff like that, which was a good job. And made some lifelong friends there. Rusty got him a job there, and now he's president of that branch. Yeah.
Wow.
He was executive vice president of the whole thing in Scottsdale, Arizona for a while. So he stayed with the company. Yeah. But anyway, those years after high school, I lived with some friends, and they were very special, just a special family.